Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to get the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock. That's ZipRecruiter.com/shock. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock. Greetings and welcome to this week's bonus episode of Shockwaves. I am your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, and with me this week, I am proud to welcome onto the show, David Ian McKendry.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Dave has co-hosted a bonus episode with me before. Dave and I, in addition to me working on Shockwaves, Dave and I have our own podcast called Our Strange World.
Yes, we do.
And Dave is kind of an expert on lore, legends.
Strangities,
oddities.
I have a PhD in strangities.
Weird factoids and things like that. And then I also definitely have a fascination in kind of weird history.
And we turned it into a podcast.
Yeah, and we turned it into a
called
podcast.
Our Strange World.
We had done the bonus episode of Shockwaves back, I guess it was around Christmas time, if I remember mm-hmm. correctly. And we talked about the Hotel Cecil, which is this real hotel in downtown Los Angeles that has all of these completely whacked stories in conjunction with it. Like one of those places where like, just so much weird stuff happens that it seems uncanny. And it ended up being what they based the American Horror Story series Hotel off of.
Right. With a little mix of The Man in the White Castle from Chicago, the H.H. Holmes story.
And so we went through all of those various stories that they had used and kind of talked about the real stuff in, behind it. And we are back this week. And this week, this is kind of our anthology show. We're going to do four weird tales of horror movies.
Right. Tales that were eventually turned into horror movies.
Well, some of them, because mine...
Or
one
were
of
influenced
mine,
by.
Yeah, one of mine is kind of the story behind the movie, and then one of them is just the most gut-churning facts that you will ever... The most gut-churning factoid you will ever
I looked at your
hear.
Notes, and I'm disturbed by something you're going to mention.
I know, you're going to be disturbed by something. It is the most Cronenbergian scientific fact ever, and we will jump into
but
that.
But wait, before we get to that, I just wanted you to notice that I am wearing my Elric shirt.
You are. Dave
I'm wearing
is...
a shirt that Elric owns, so... So just to keep the spirit here.
It's pretty trippy because Elric and Dave not only have a couple of the same t-shirts.
Wait, hold on.
They drink the same liquor. Dave is currently toasting to Elric. They also have the same taste in movies. So the same arguing that I do on the show often occurs on my couch as we break down.
Do I have to defend possession?
No, I tolerate possession. All right. Like that one. But Dave is definitely more of kind of the art horror kind of guy, arty film guy.
He's into these films where people sit around talking about feelings.
That's pretty much it. I always say like a Dave movie is two guys driving cross country talking about their feelings while doing drugs, and then something scary happens for 5 minutes, and then they get back in the car and there's no ending. That is like the
ideal. I love
ideal.
That movie.
I know,
oh my
right?
God.
That's like your ideal movie.
Yeah.
Whereas mine has explosions and probably a couple oversized octopuses, maybe a nun. Definitely explosions. So.
And then they talk about their feelings with the octopus.
That would be pretty badass.
Two nuns talking to an octopus about their feelings.
So since it is standard on Shockwaves, we usually start with everything that we've seen this week. So it's not going to be widely varied.
We
because
live together.
I know.
So.
Everything we've seen, we tend to watch together.
I could go through all the things when you were out of town last week that I saw. But I don't think we can talk about Wonder Woman and Captain America movies on this podcast.
Not as much on this one, no. Okay. This is not quite the audience for it. Although I will give a mad shout out to Glow, which Dave and we kind of binge watched that in like 2 days.
It took us 2 days to get through that.
Yep. And we ended up, the episode of our other podcast that we do, Our Strange World, we did Weird Tales from Wrestling this week because we were so inspired by Glow.
Which we'll post Thursday.
So, yeah, that'll post. It'll be up by the time this show posts. So I highly recommend checking that out. But we ended up watching The Source Family, which I can't say is horror exactly, the Source Family documentary. But it's weird enough that I think that this audience would be into it. Mm-hmm. So you can go back to Our Strange World. One of our prior episodes that we did on that was on sexual cults in Los Angeles.
It's called Sexual Perversity in Sexual Perversity in Los Angeles is the name of the episode.
Yeah, and it's on real life sex cults that were in Los Angeles. And there's this one that happened in the late 60s, early 70s called The Source Family. The Source Family was a real cult that happened in Los Angeles in the late 60s, early 70s.
And I have a hard time calling them a cult because when you watch the documentary, they didn't fall into the line of like the cult leader stole all my money or made me drink Kool-Aid and kill myself sort of cult.
Yeah, like everyone who was in this weird sex cult just kind of left and was like, yeah, man, that was a cool time. Like, they all just kind of seemed okay with it.
They were only really pissed off when the cult leader decided that he wanted to take 14 wives.
Yeah.
So that was like...
So that was our takeaway is if you're going to be a cult leader, don't suddenly decide out of nowhere. Because the cult had been rocking for a couple of years at this point. And then like out of nowhere, the guy who ran it, Father Yod, was suddenly like, dude, I want 13 wives. All of them. They're mine.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, everything kind of fell apart. So that seems to be the downfall of cult leaders.
And they had like a great band going too.
Yeah.
Like, acid jazz band that they had there. And they had one of the first natural food health stores in Los Angeles.
It was a vegetarian restaurant.
Yeah, it was one of the first.
And it's a taco stand now, Dave, and I went by there just to check it out.
And actually, going back to movies, it was featured in a lot of films in the 1960s.
It was in Annie Hall.
There was a heist movie I remember that was shot there.
But it's worth checking out just because if you're interested in kind of weird history and kind of the real stories that influence a lot of horror movies, it's a fascinating look at kind of how a cult is created, how it's maintained, the weird stuff that goes into it. And
as a cult, they were fine, but I kind of checked out when they got into the renting a 3-bedroom house and having 150 people live in it.
I don't think I could do that.
That I was kind of,
it would make me question my cult dedication.
Yeah,
Anyway, that is the Source Family documentary, and it is currently
on Netflix.
It's on Amazon.
Oh, you're right. It is
on Amazon. Watched that on Amazon.
It's on the documentary channel on Amazon.
The documentary channel on Amazon. But then the horror film that we watched last night. So Life got really mixed reviews when it came out. Actually, I can't even call them mixed. Like most people just said it's fucking bad. Like it really did not get a lot of love, except for Ryan Turek, who said, I kind of like this movie. And
I actually did like
this
movie.
I know. I got to agree. It maybe had I seen this in the theater, I think I would have been angry.
What's funny is when you title a film Life and it's a sci-fi film about aliens, it almost guarantees it's going to be a real downer of a film.
Yeah, like you know something bad's going to
happen.
And I
thought that's what the direction they were going for a while because it was very mellow and moody. And then all of a sudden it just kicked into this huge action film. This like from the second act onward, it was just nothing but action.
Now, I do have to say, had I seen this in the theater, I might be a little angry because it didn't feel like anything that I hadn't seen before. But that said, it felt like stuff I'd seen before that I liked. So I was more tolerant to like sit there with a bowl of popcorn and just shove popcorn in my face by going, wow, that alien's growing fast.
And it was kind of like a Gravity with an alien.
Yeah, it was like Gravity with an alien. It really was. I can see why some critically it was questionable. Had I been reviewing it, I think I would have been inclined to say, I don't really know if it did anything groundbreaking or anything different, or, you know, I could name 5 other films that I feel kind of fall into the same line of, oh, we found alien life. Let's make alien life. We've made alien life and now it's out of control. So
I would have been the guy in the back as it grew too fast going, burn it, kill it.
Well, there were some of those. There were people in the back going, burn it, kill it.
The second it was the size of a dime overnight,
kill it. But yeah. So I do have to say, if you are into kind of big action films, big like sci-fi horror action films, I recommend checking out Life.
Where do you put it in terms of Prometheus?
I like Prometheus better because Prometheus did stuff I'd never seen before. Okay. There were definitely moments in Prometheus where I was like, I've never thought about that. Yes, who created the aliens? Who created us? The whole cesarean scene, like Prometheus, there was things that I'd never seen before. This, there was nothing.
I've never seen an abortion machine before.
I know, right?
It's insane.
In a year, if you asked me to recall a scene from this movie, I think I might be able to call the way that the alien looked, but I don't think I would be able to recall many scenes.
Right.
Like, there was nothing really groundbreaking, but it was still fun. So, yeah, I don't think it should have gotten quite as slammed as it did.
Agreed. So that being said, I think I really want to dive into this story we teased when we opened up here.
Oh God, which
so
one?
So to speak.
Which one?
The gruesome one.
No, I can't start with the most heinous story ever. This thing is like, seriously, like I was reading this to somebody as I was doing the research. I was reading it to one of the guys at the office and he was turning white. I think I have to save this for the end.
All right. Well, so, now that we've talked it up so much.
I know,
I'm
right? Now I have
letdown.
To save it for the end.
All right, then you know what? I'll jump in. I'll start us off. Shall
okay.
I? Shall I start us off?
Well, I don't. I really want to save my carnage for the end.
All right, I'll let you get all nasty at the end.
Yeah, and I do have some Nosferatu Dracula history coming up that's really freaking fascinating. But right. I want to start with yours just because...
We sound like old 1970s DJs.
I know,
like,
right?
We got some Nosferatu coming up in the next hour.
No, Dave, kick us off with some voodoo here.
Voodoo. Let me lay some voodoo down on you. Let's start with The Serpent and the Rainbow, Craven's 1988 horror classic.
So Dave has a specialization, and you do this on Blumhouse.com. Dave's specialization is finding out the true story behind movies. So like where the movie came from.
The inspiration,
yeah.
The true stories.
So like there was, you know, all these legends that Hostel is based on a real website that was advertising where you could like kill for fun and things like that. So then Dave spends like days investigating if this is real.
Ask Jeeves.
Ask Jeeves, right?
It was Ask Jeeves, yeah.
Days investigating if it's real, trying to figure out what's true, what's not, what's urban legend and where kind of the lines are drawn and where it may have come from. So a couple of years ago, we were watching Serpent in the Rainbow. It's when Scream Factory did the re-release Blue of it, which is absolutely beautiful. And Rob Galuza worked on that as well. And when they did that, we were watching it and Dave was like, you know, this is based on a real story. And I was like, bullshit.
Well, no, yeah, I'd always heard about the powders and that they had used to create zombies. So yeah, give a little backstory into the film. It's takes place in Haiti, and it's about a scientist or an anthropologist that goes down to Haiti to solve a mystery of a man believed dead who suddenly one day appears with no recollection of who he is and where he's been.
And these zombies, we should state, just in case people are not too up on their voodoo movies, these zombies are different. These are not like Walking Dead like we came to know in the 1960s.
Brains.
Yeah, this is the first kind of mention of voodoo was from the early 1900s. I think it was in the 1920s with a book called This Magic Island. And it was the first one to kind of describe the voodoo Haitian zombie, which is just kind of a brainwash.
It's more of a mind control. It's more of a creating slaves because, mm-hmm. you know, we're in an area that was built by slaves. So there's a way of creating slaves.
Yeah.
They use through voodoo practices.
In their mythology and in the original book, it was talking about how it was kind of like their worst fear. It was like a living nightmare to be under this mind control, but that it could be done with all of these specific chemicals. And then we see that same kind of concept come up over and over and over again throughout film history and White Zombie. And then during the late 70s, early 80s, we had a lot of voodoo movies come out. The most popular one probably being Serpent in the Rainbow.
One of my favorite ones. So.
Yeah. Really well done. There's some really terrifying moments in that movie.
Still scares me.
Yeah.
So The Serpent in the Rainbow, the film comes from the book of the same name by ethnobotanist Wade Davis, who traveled to Haiti to research the real case of a man by the name of Clervius Narcissus, a supposedly real zombie.
And so this is like an actual like book, like a nonfiction book that this dude wrote
about going
to find a zombie.
Yeah, this is his log of traveling to Haiti to find this real zombie. The story of Clervius is that he checked into a local hospital around 1962.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't feeling well. And when he arrived, he started experiencing a lot of different ailments. He was having fever, trouble breathing. He claimed there were bugs crawling all over his skin. And it didn't take long before he actually just died right there in the hospital. Doctors pronounced him dead.
They had no idea what was causing it.
No idea what was going on with him. And so a few days later, he was buried. But then one day in 1981, his sister saw him walking down the street.
Which has got to be trippy.
Which is 19 years later and has got to be really trippy. So Wade Davis goes down to investigate this, and he discovers a type of black magic priest called a Bukhor. Bukhor is said to have unique power that can bring the dead back as zombie slaves. So it was believed that the Bukhor could place someone in a trance that would fool doctors into believing that the person was dead. Then once buried, the Bukhor would dig up the body and then sell him to a sugar plantation as slave labor. It's a little like 1932's Bela Lugosi's White Zombie.
Little nut, yeah. It's also like Shelley Long's Hello again.
It is like that again. But yeah, in White Zombie, he's a sugar plantation owner who creates his own zombies.
Yeah.
So yeah, and you were saying before that the zombies dated back to around the early 1900s.
That's so, yeah. When there was a book then, which ended up becoming a Broadway play, which ended up becoming the inspiration for White Zombie. So yeah, it all kind of goes back to this, you know, creating slaves for your sugar plantation.
Gets its stuff from some real stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Some real voodoo.
So tell us here, can you actually turn somebody into a slave?
So what he discovered was there was a tetrodotoxin powder that when rubbed onto an abrasion on the skin would cause these symptoms. And tetrodotoxin powder coming from the pufferfish, if you're familiar with it, it's a very extremely poisonous fish.
Fugu
from The Simpsons. So he discovered that this causes the comatose state that fooled doctors into believing that Clavius was dead.
So all you have to do is somebody has a cut, you just rub this tetra pulverized pufferfish.
Or you have it on something that abrases the skin already and gets
it
right into the skin.
It makes them appear to be dead and then they come back 3 days later.
Yeah, and he also found that there were other things included into this powder for the zombification process, like a powerful hallucinogen.
Oh, so they would like totally trip out and think that they went to hell and then came
back?
Yeah,
that's like the bugs on the skin and these freaking out. Nobody knows what's wrong with them. They also found the ground up human bones were also part of this powder they used.
Of course.
Which probably had very little effect on the process. But there was also Datura, a flowering plant which causes delirium, which is the inability to distinguish reality from fantasy. It also causes hyperthermia, which is an increase in body temperature, which is the fever. And it also causes tachycardia, which is an increase in heart rate. And then in some cases, it causes pronounced amnesia, which is why when Clavius came back, he didn't know what had happened to him or who he was. He was just a mindless slave.
So this, even though that it's not actually brainwashing you, it's this cocktail of drugs that end up making you think that maybe you've been brainwashed or been to hell if you're under a very suggestive state. And then when you come back, you might be perfectly fine, but you think
you don't remember anything
about
at all.
Your prior
and,
life.
Yeah, and we see that in the Serpent and the Rainbow, because he had some hella wicked hallucinations in that film.
He had a tiger. Yeah. Or was it? There was some type of giant cat playing with him. It may have been like a panther or something.
There was, and he was rolling around the ground
with a
panther at one point. And so yeah, the it presents itself initially as death, so doctors declare you dead, and then when you come back, when you're dug up, you have no memory of anything.
So I assume that this is illegal.
I would assume so as well.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. It hasn't made its way to the states that I know of yet.
We don't have a big pufferfish population.
Yeah.
So might be a little harder to get your hands on the
I know
supply.
A guy.
You know a guy?
I know a guy.
Pufferfish.
It's the human bone that's kind of hard to get.
No doubt. Well, for our next story of the weird, which actually isn't all that weird. It's just really freaking fascinating. I absolutely love this story. I discussed this on our first episode of Our Strange World. I think I did this one, but I figured that it would be definitely appealing for Shockwaves listeners. I'm going to talk about the time that Dracula sued Nosferatu. Most horror fans are familiar, if not have seen Nosferatu, the 1920s film, especially if you were an actual like film student in any way. It's like one of the first ones that they kind of push out.
Or if
out.
You've seen David Bowie and Queens Under Pressure.
Yeah, that works as well. But for horror fans specifically, the 1920s Nosferatu, it's canon. Like you definitely have watched that. It's this example of German expressionism and silent horror. And it's absolutely, absolutely amazing. But the origin story behind it, where it came from, and how it ended up getting the shit sued out of it by Dracula is a really fascinating tale, which goes back to 19...
I'm sorry, but for 1 second, when you say that Nosferatu, Dracula sued Nosferatu, why do I always get an image of the People's Court in my head? Because that would be the greatest thing ever, is just Nosferatu and Dracula walking through the entrance of the people's court.
I guarantee one of our listeners is now going to like Photoshop that with Judge Judy in the middle.
Thank you.
I need this. So please.
Judge Wapner.
Tweet this Facebook as we want to see this picture. So the story of Nosferatu goes back to 1916 and this guy named Alban Grau. And Alban is a German who is serving in World War I and he's in Serbia at the time. And he himself had always been really fascinated by the occult. Like, actually, if you research him, he was a self-defined occultist. I don't even know what that kind of meant at the time. I'm an occultist. I think that it just
meant...
You can
put self-defined in front of anything.
I know. But at the time period, it just kind of meant that he was fascinated in otherworldly things. He was well-read. And so while he was serving in Serbia in World War I, he was hearing a lot of Serbian ghost stories about vampires. And they weren't presented as ghost stories. The actual like country rural folk in Serbia were presenting these as fact. Like, if you do this, a vampire will come get you. And there are vampires. And that guy over there is a vampire. And his wife's a vampire. Everybody's a vampire. And so
Everybody vampire.
Alban Grau got very amused with these vampire legends and decided that as soon as he got back to Germany, he was going to make a vampire film. So he got back after the war and he founded this company called Prana Films. And his whole intention of creating Prana Films was to make a vampire movie. So he hires a screenwriter, and then right after that, he hires filmmaker F.W. Murnau. And they have the intention of creating a really stylized version of Dracula. And that's specifically what his intentions were from the beginning, is he wanted to make a Dracula movie. Well, Dracula was definitely popular by this time. The novel came out in 1897, so we're talking like almost 20 years later. The novel is really popular, and it has fallen into public domain in some regions. It's in public domain in the U.S. by this point and a couple other countries. But in Germany, which is where they were based, it is not in public domain yet. So Bram Stoker had died in 1912, and, you know, there was some public domain that had happened around the U.S., but in Germany, it was still not in public domain. All of the rights were being held by Stoker's widow, Florence Stoker. At this point, it becomes a little murky. It's not clear if Alban Grau just didn't go to Florence Stoker and ask for rights permissions, or perhaps she quoted him too high and he just said, no, to hell with that, I'm not going to pay. Or maybe Florence just said, no, you can't have rights to this novel in any capacity. But regardless, he didn't get rights. And somehow Florence was kind of aware of what was going on and wasn't happy about it. But Alban Grau does not get rights to Dracula in any capacity. So he still decides to go ahead and make the movie. Still saying it's going to be a highly stylized version of Dracula. They begin filming in 1921. And he, knowing that there were going to be some rights issues, made some changes. So he decided that he would change the name from Dracula to Count Orlok, because he hadn't secured the rights yet. So, you know, he'd at least do that. So Dracula became Count Orlok. He changed, instead of saying the word vampire, he said the word Nosferatu, which is the Romanian word for vampire. He changed the major characters' names, like we don't have Lucy and Jonathan like we do in the novel. Instead of making the head vampire very refined and poetic and aristocratic like Dracula is, he made Nosferatu, Count Orlok, more animalistic and feral and kind of just like sickly, like he looks like a bat. He also includes this idea of plague, which is a little bit different. Like, he never actually says that, you know, Count Orlok is feeding on people specifically the way that it's presented in Dracula. It's still definitely there, but it's not quite as specific. Instead, he discusses that everywhere this particular character goes, that this plague follows, this sickness follows, and all these people in the town die. So he makes these kind of rather minute, but I guess, you know, they're changes nonetheless. He changes the character names. So they make the movie, and it's beautiful and brilliant, and Murnau does amazing things with it, and it's a fine example of German expressionism and silent film, and it's a great example of special effects at the time period, how they do a lot of stop motion. Comes out in 1922. Well, the movie comes out and doesn't get a lot of coverage, but on the night that they release Nosferatu in 1922, they throw this giant freaking post-release party. And they invite everybody who's anybody in Germany. And that gets a ton of press. So the party itself is getting all this press. Somehow, a copy of the poster for Nosferatu makes its way back to Florence Stoker. Now, I'm not sure at this point if Alban Grau had done this himself, or if this was just like a major marketing snafu on some like poster designer's part. But at the bottom of the poster, it says, freely adapted from Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Whoops.
And this gets sent to Florence Stoker. And so she's like, man, I got you now. And she sues the shit out of him. And there's really nothing that Alban Grau or Prana Films can say because it says on the poster that they adapted it from Dracula. And so Stoker sues him. Prana Films has absolutely no defense. They cannot say anything because it's written on the damn poster. And the judge who was handling the case said that any of the changes that were made from the original Dracula concept were negligible at best. So Prana Films has no defense. They have to declare bankruptcy.
Do you think maybe they did that just so she would see it and see the film and be like, oh, they did this great adaptation of my husband's work and they're paying tribute to him?
Though I think that that is a tactic that might be done today in Hollywood.
Just to get the endorsement of her,
just
maybe?
Just to get the endorsement. I don't think that that was their intention. I honestly think that they would have wanted to keep it off of her radar. And, you know, and they're in different countries. So at the time, it would have seemed like a world away. But Florence sues. Prana Films goes declares bankruptcy. Now, as part of this, the whole lawsuit thing, the judgment was that they had to destroy all copies of Nosferatu. All of the films had to be destroyed. And they were. They burned like whatever copies they had in Germany, except one. Somehow one copy of the film makes its way over to the U.S. And Nosferatu starts getting shown a lot in the U.S. So by like the end of the 1920s, enough people were seeing Nosferatu that it was starting to get some name to it. And it was because of this copy of Nosferatu making its way overseas and becoming somewhat popular here in the U.S. that ultimately Universal decided to make Dracula in 1931. So because of the bootleg Dracula, Nosferatu, they ended up making a legit version of Dracula in 1931, which did far more for Dracula's fame than, you know, anything else ever could have.
But you have to imagine if this one print didn't make it here, the films that we wouldn't have.
Yeah, because of that. Because if we look back at like the origin of vampires on screen, everyone points to Nosferatu as being the first one.
I mean, we wouldn't have Twilight if...
I think that, man. Well, I don't know. I can't picture a Twilight.
Can you imagine
a world
without Twilight?
A world without Twilight. Well, Florence Stoker apparently never gave up. She fought all of the screenings of Nosferatu that were happening around the world up until she died in 1937. She was still fighting these screenings.
Bitter woman.
Yeah, she was never able to keep it down. The print kept rising from the grave. By the 1960s, the Dracula novel was in public domain worldwide, and so Nosferatu was finally able to be shown home in Germany.
And remade by Klaus Kinski.
Yeah, and but it was because of Dracula suing Nosferatu that it ended up kind of becoming like a screening here in the U.S. that led to the Universal one.
Wow.
So that is the story of how Dracula sued Nosferatu.
That's very cool. Yeah. So next, let's go to the town that Silent Hill was based off of. The town of Centralia, Pennsylvania.
You have odd facts about this, right?
I do have some odd facts about this and some really interesting history as well. Centralia, Pennsylvania, it's along the Appalachian mountain range there. And one big thing about the Appalachian mountain range is that it's mostly coal mining. So what you have is just these little coal towns. I remember in college, we went to Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
Which is in the northern area there, which is a steel mill town, but it also one time was a coal mining town. And as you go down there, you just see all these coal mining towns. Well, Centralia, which gave the inspiration for Silent Hill, and you know, in the film and the video game Silent Hill, you have this strange town that's covered in ash, weird flames coming out of the ground.
The town itself is kind of constantly burning.
Yeah, exactly. But burning from underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a town in America where it is burning from underneath. Burning underneath the streets, underneath the houses. And to go back to the history of Centralia, in 1749, it was sold by the Native Americans to the colonists. And it wasn't until around 1800 when coal was discovered there. And then the real value of this land was known. For a while, it wasn't really profitable to take the coal out until the trains started rolling through there. And then it became profitable around 1856 to start coal mining this area. At the time, if you're familiar with coal mining during the 1800s, mid-1800s, coal mining is probably the most brutal business.
Well,
that you can.
It still sucks, but
sucks.
But at the time, it was like incredibly dangerous, right?
Well, not only incredibly dangerous, but incredibly cruel to the people who did it. But it's after the railroads that what starts happening is that coal mining companies start taking over these towns where there's heavy reserves of coal. And coal mining companies start running towns all over the Appalachians, from Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, Tennessee. Wherever there's coal, a coal mining company will purchase that area, and they will essentially build a town mm-hmm. around the coal mine. The coal company will build the schools. They'll build the homes that the workers live in. They'll build the shops that the workers and their families shop in. Everything's owned by the coal mine company, including law enforcement. They'll actually hire the sheriff. So if you have a complaint against the coal company, tough shit.
This sounds corrupt.
It is very corrupt. It is extremely corrupt, especially when a lot of these coal companies will pay their workers in what's called scrip, which is kind of like if you went to Disney World and you got Disney dollars.
I was going
to
say, this sounds like Chuck E. Cheese dollars, where you like trade in your $5 and they give you like 20 tokens.
Essentially,
and so now you have
that's
Chuck
what
e.
it
Cheese
is.
Dollars.
And you can spend them at the company store. You know, that song, load 16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper
in
debt.
I owe my soul to
the
company
store. That's exactly it. Because sometimes you wouldn't work enough to get enough scrip to pay for something like your meals for your family for the week. And so you'd have to take it on credit. And so people would owe a lot of credit to the company store, and they'd become indentured to the coal mining company.
So you end up owing money to your employer.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and there are some cases where you could trade your scrip in for actual money, but it's usually done at about 75 cents on the dollar.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
So there's like an inflation rate going on there as well. So this
exactly.
is all one shady freaking
this
business.
This is a shady thing. It's shady freaking business, and it's a very unsafe business as well. Just in that one area alone around Centralia, they had in 1869, 40 miles north of Centralia in Plymouth, Pennsylvania, was the Avondale Mine Fire, which killed 110 miners. The fire broke out into the mine, and most of those deaths are attributed to the fact that the company refused to install emergency exits in the shaft so that people could actually get out if the place caught fire. So a lot of people asphyxiated or burned to death because they couldn't get out of the mine. And then, you know, 15 miles to the east of Centralia in Schuylkill County, 566 miners died over the course of 7 years because of these safety issues. To further compound this, the philosophy of the company is that if you kill a mule, you have to spend money to buy another mule. If you kill a worker, you just go out and find another worker. Most of these are young Irish laborers who come to this country, and there's an extreme racist attitude towards the Irish in the city. So they arrive here, and you'll see signs that say Irish need not apply, but they can go work in the coal mine, mm-hmm. no problem. And yeah, and the owners are completely cruel. When workers die, most of the time they're just buried in unmarked graves close to the mine.
My God, that's horrible.
It is horrible. It is horrible. And even on top of that, if your husband dies in the mine and you live in a company house, you're kicked out that very day and another family has moved in.
So some really freaking harsh conditions
here. Yeah, harsh conditions. So you can see how if there's one industry that's going to have a lot of curses involved in it.
We'll call it bad legends around
bad mojo.
So how does an entire town catch fire?
Around 1929, we have the stock market crash. Mm-hmm. The mine shut down. That doesn't mean people stop going into the mines. A lot of people go in there illegally and do what's called pillar robbing, where they will take the pillars that have been left behind by the miners to hold the ceilings up.
Oh, they're like the support beams.
The support beams, and they're pretty much made of coal, and they will start taking away from those.
You can only do that for so long before
they can
collapse,
only do that
right?
for so long, and then they did have several of these labyrinth. I mean, a coal mine is just a vast labyrinth of tunnels and giant openings, mm-hmm. and they have several of these collapse. So that already sets the stage for what's going on under the ground there. And 1932, maybe 10 miles down the road from Centralia, there is a fire that happens in one of the mines. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they flood the mine with water in hopes of putting it out, and then they seal it off. And that happens not that far from Centralia. And as you understand, these are all labyrinths of tunnels, so...
connected.
Things are all connected. Now, that's one theory of how this fire caught in 1962.
That it had spread from this other
that
mine.
That it spread from another mine. Another theory of it is that the town council was trying to decide what to do with their landfill, so they got the volunteer fire department to just set it on fire. And the embers somehow got into an open shaft and set fire to whatever coal and fuel was under the ground.
But somehow, all of the coal seams under Centralia catch fire, and by the mid-1960s, the entire town is burning from underneath.
From underneath. And it starts in 1962, really. That's when the main fire starts, and they can't stop it. It's feeding off of the coal and the oxygen that's going through the mine shaft, and several openings start coming up all over town. Just little spouts of fire, little spouts of steam coming up in random areas. Like, you could be out mowing your lawn, and all of a sudden you just see the earth open up and a little bit of steam starts coming out of it. So they don't really see it as a problem yet.
Really?
No. I mean, it's just a little fire under the town. This is a town of 2,000 people at the time. And a lot of these people have lived there all their lives. They lived there when the mines were open. And
they have no intention of leaving.
They're not very anxious to go anywhere. For the next 16 years, the town is attempting to extinguish the fire.
16 years they keep trying to put
these fires
out.
They keep trying to put it out for 16 years. They're going to stay in town. They're just going to flood the tunnels when they can.
Isn't this stuff toxic? Like, when you burn coal, especially if you're burning, like, underground, isn't it releasing toxic gases?
It is releasing toxic gases. And they don't really realize the extent of the problem they're having until around the 1970s, late 70s, the town mayor and owner of a gas station, John Coddington, goes out to check the levels of the gas in his underground tanks, mm-hmm. puts a dipstick down on the ground, pulls it out, and feels that it's really hot. So he puts a thermometer on it, puts it down in there, pulls it out. It's reading 172 degrees Fahrenheit. So the gasoline under the ground is already at 172.
Oh my gosh. So everything's going to explode.
Yeah, it's near the exploding point. So they start to realize maybe this isn't as under control as we thought. They're also starting to experience some health problems. People are blacking out, and they're realizing that there's a lot of carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, and methane being leaked out of these cracks in the earth. Mm-hmm. And one by one, town folks start saying, well, we have to leave. You know, now they're getting to the point where they have to leave. And it was around 1981 that a 12-year-old boy who was out playing in his yard, fell into a sinkhole that opened up under his feet.
Oh my gosh.
It was a 4 foot wide by 100 foot deep, 150 foot deep sinkhole. Just opens up.
Was he okay?
He managed to grab onto the side, and his cousin pulled him out. And then they measured the steam coming out of the hole and realized that it was lethal doses of carbon monoxide are just pouring out of the ground.
So at this point, people start moving out of the city, right? Because when we toured it, there were houses there, but there was no, it was desolate.
By the 1980s, the town is actually still divided as to what to do. And so many people want to leave. And the Congress, this Pennsylvania Congress, allotted $42 million for relocation mm-hmm. for everyone. Most of the people took the money and moved on. Around 1992, Governor Bob Casey invoked eminent domain and seized all the property. 2002, the post office took away the Centralia zip code. Mm-hmm. So you can't mail anything there now. And then in 2009, the next governor, Governor Ed Randall, started evicting the remaining residents. But to this day, there are still, according to census, 10 people living in Centralia.
Oh my goodness.
And you can see their houses. Their houses look fine. But if you go to certain areas of it, you can still see steam coming out of the ground.
Yeah, when Dave and I went, most of the roads, and I don't know how much of this is like what's happening underneath the ground versus them just not maintaining the roads. Like, all the roads are cracked. Most of them are cracked open and becoming dirt slowly.
Well, they diverted the highway.
Okay.
So what they did was, there was a main road that used to go through Centralia. They diverted that about maybe a mile to the mm-hmm. east of it. But all those old roads are still there, but they're not going to be taken care of.
Yeah, so like they're going to start not maintained.
And a lot of them are buckling to the gases pushing out underneath.
That's what we saw, is a lot of the roads look like, you know, they had buckled. It looks like after you see like snow plows come through and things like that, but on right. much more extreme. A lot of spray paint. And there was also this part, we didn't see any steam, but we did see where the asphalt was softening.
Yeah.
So it was like tar, like everything had like a sheen of tar on it. Like, you could tell that it was
under high heat.
And you could put your hand down on the ground and you could feel the heat coming up from the ground.
Now, we didn't go at night, but I had heard from some people that at night you can actually see parts of the mountain around there glowing.
Oh, wow.
From the fires underneath.
So how long is it supposed to burn for?
It will burn for another 250 years, they say.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So yeah, next time you're cruising through Pennsylvania, find yourself somewhere around the Appalachians for some reason, swing on by, check it out.
The Burning City from Silent Hill.
I still want to go back at night and see if I can't see if it glow. Because there's a lot of, I didn't know this, but in doing my research, this isn't the only burning coal mine.
Seriously, I thought that this was like a unicorn of burning coal mines.
No,
happens once.
It happens. It happens more times than you'd think. And there's areas around there. I think one is Mount Carmel. Is nearby there.
I had no idea there was more than one burning city.
Which is burning. People claim that at night you can see glow spots on the mountain, and you can still see steam, carbon monoxide steam rising up out of it.
Well, next summer when we take Our Strange World on the road and also do a couple of bonus Shockwaves podcasts from there, we will broadcast live from the flames.
We need to have an Our Strange World / Shockwaves minivan perhaps a
travel the world
VW bus of some kind.
That sounds more us.
I think a school bus, actually.
A school bus, a renovated school bus with like one of those metal, what do you call it, bunk beds in the back, which we'll have to bolt down so they don't like tumble. But
exactly,
it sounds totally sleazy. I'm into it.
If we can get the listeners who are going to give us a People's Court rendering of Nosferatu and Dracula to give us a rendering of a school bus as well,
with some good graphics on the side. Yeah. I'm picturing an eagle, maybe a Viking. I want it to look like a Molly Hatchet cover album.
I want me to be the man Viking holding an American flag and an eagle. No, a hammer. I want a hammer.
A hammer?
I want
a hammer
of Thor.
That's more Molly Hatchet.
I want the hammer
of
Thor.
Okay, we've got our bus planned. All right. Okay, so for our final story of the day, I stumbled on this little tidbit of information one day while I was researching Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I am such, as you've probably learned from regularly listening to Shockwaves, I'm kind of like a dork.
I almost said redhead.
No, redhead.
Sorry.
No, I'm like a research dork where I will find one thing and then I will kind of fixate on it, and it will be like a rabbit hole for me where like 10 years later, I'm still like uncovering more layers for it. And so I was researching something on Texas Chainsaw Massacre one day, and it suddenly occurred to me that I really wanted to research if, after Texas Chainsaw Massacre, if there had been a surge in consumer-grade chainsaw purchases, or was the movie and the inspiration for Toby Hooper part of a surge in consumer-grade chainsaw purchases. So I wanted to see kind of like, I wanted a flowchart of like chainsaw purchases around the same time that the movie came out.
Did
so
somebody
you could
keep
see.
That record?
No one. I could not find that record.
Did you call Black & Decker?
I did not. Black & Decker.
Or still?
Husqvarna. Nobody helped me on this one. But so while I'm trying to research buying practices of consumer-grade chainsaws in the 1970s.
Like normal people do.
I started researching the origins of the chainsaw, because then I was like, well, what, you know, maybe the chainsaw had just been, you know, like just come on the market around this time as a consumer grade item. And maybe that's why, you know, there was like a surplus, because you saw a bunch of chainsaw films come out around that time, which were all ripoffs of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But there was a lot of chainsaw action around the mid to late 70s.
Was there an electric chainsaw massacre?
Like your corded?
Like the corded one where you just...
No, I assume if you're going to do that, it would be like Driller Killer, where he goes out and buys himself a battery belt pack.
Or somebody, a friend with a lot of extension cords that keeps adding to it as he's going further away.
That was a joke in Idle Hands where he was coming at him with an electric knife and then it unplugs.
Oh, so okay.
It's been done.
Damn it.
Yeah, it's been done.
But, all right, canceling production.
Anyway, I'm researching the origins of the chainsaw, and then what I discover while researching the origins of the chainsaw is quite possibly one of the most horrific facts that I have ever learned in my life. The chainsaw was originally invented to aid in gynecology and childbirth.
Yay.
So welcome to your cringeworthy moment for the day. Around 1780.
And you don't have to be a woman to appreciate the cringefulness of this.
And it's going to get a lot worse. Around 1780, two surgeons are trying to advance the art of this procedure that they do at the time. It's still done today occasionally, called, and I'm going to chew this word, symphysotomy. Mm-hmm. Symphysiotomy. Essentially what it is, and the lunch is about to come up at this point, it's widening of the birth canal via knives and removing tissue and chiseling bone down.
Like a episiotomy sort of thing?
No, or? No, that's a snipping. That's okay, a snipping.
That's a snipping. So, all right, then.
This is literally like, if you picture, since we've been talking about coal tunnels, this is literally whittling down the walls of the coal tunnel to get a bigger cart through, in this case, a baby's head.
So you're pillar mining the birth canal. Okay.
So this was the preferred, if you were having a troubled birth, like the birth canal is not wide enough for the baby, which is actually pretty common. It still is today. Like, you know, there's a lot of different reasons that births get into trouble. This was the preferred.
Who would have known pushing a cantaloupe through something the size of a grape?
It's a little difficult.
Yeah.
This was the preferred method in the late 1700s, as opposed to cesarean. Today, if you're like, you know, if there's any type of problem, they're like, you know what? We'll just pop you in cesarean. It's quick. It's still not pleasant, especially not to think about, but because medical practices were still unsterile at the time, there was still a heavy risk for infection, the chiseling of bone and tissue out of the birth canal was preferred to sawing mom in half because there was a much bigger risk at the time. Now, let's also remember that this is done in the throes of childbirth and labor because this was like a last-ditch effort.
What years are we talking about?
1780 was when this was invented. So this had been being done. Anesthesia. That was my first thing was like, okay, well, were they numbing women? Were they like knocking them out during this time? And the answer is no. This was being done in the throes of childbirth with no anesthetic. Anesthetic, as we know it today, was invented around the late 1700s. So around this same time period, but it was not in common use yet. So at this time, this procedure is being done after mom has been in labor for 10 hours. Nothing is moving this baby. This is what we have to do.
I watch a lot of horror films and they don't bother me, but the film that always gets to me are the Revolutionary War films where they're being very period accurate and they'll have wounded soldiers with gangrene setting in their wounds and they will amputate.
Yeah.
And they will show, there are a few films out there that will show the amputation.
And they will show it with knives.
And they'll show it with knives or saws and it'll always be like, bite down on the spoon and guy just going at it without any anesthesia. And that's the only thing in a movie that gets me.
So when you think about this, it really makes me feel bad for whining about how shitty the hospital food was when I gave birth both times. Because that was like my big complaint was
because your births were really hard on me too.
Yeah, they were rough on you. No, like you complained about the uncomfortable cot. And I remember that I was like, they put those leg cuffs on my legs to like increase circulation. Yeah. And I was complaining because they were loud.
The weird thing about the childbirth from my male point of view was at the time you're in this weird white room and everything's surreal and a reality is setting in and you're kind of swimming in your own brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I would react if the doctor suddenly said, okay, let's use the chainsaw.
So that's where this is coming in. So at the time, this bone chiseling and tissue chiseling procedure was being done because we are talking about a vagina still. It was being done with knives and a saw, very small knives and a saw. Mm-hmm. And it was very grueling for both the mother and the doctors. And she's in labor at the time. So it was just awful, awful procedure. And again, no anesthetic.
Is she expected to enjoy life ever again after this?
I don't know. The shit was hard in the 1780s.
That's why all those pictures are just the most stoic faces.
They're just angry looking women. So in 1780, two Scottish surgeons said, you know what? This procedure sucks for everybody involved. What can we do to change this? And they created, and when you look at this device, it's haunting to think what it was being used for, but I guess it's preferred over like saws and chisels. It looks like a kitchen knife with a bicycle chain wrapped around it and an egg beater crank on the side.
Oh, like one of those old style hand crank egg
beaters. It's a hand crank egg beater.
But instead of two things spinning, it's one thing cutting.
It's a sharp chain around a kitchen knife. And so they create this, and it's small. I mean, don't picture it's not like, you know, a giant 20-inch, like, two-cycle chainsaw. it's small. It's vagina size. And so they create this device to use for this procedure. And so it still, even like looking at it now, even though I'm like, it's a little smaller, it's still like the size of like a kitchen paring knife. And it still looks like the most Cronenbergian device.
Well, you're cutting
ever.
Bone. I mean, just the idea of cutting bone with anything.
It's bad. It's bad.
Especially when you're going at the bone from a very sensitive area, I would imagine.
So what they discovered after using this several times was that it worked really well. As opposed to the first procedure, to what used to be. This worked much better. And then they quickly discovered that this chain on a knife with a hand crank worked not just well for like sawing, you know, mom's midsection.
I wonder how
also
long it took to convince the first woman to try it.
You know, I bet after 12 hours of labor and thinking that your baby's going to die and like you might be in medical distress too, that you would just kind of be like, yeah, go with it. Like, I don't know if they would give you a choice or if it would just be like a strap her down. We have to do this. I don't see medical practices in general having a lot of consent involved at the time. There's no HIPAA laws.
I see a lot of arguments for celibacy in this period right now.
No, I completely agree. Honestly, if this is like on the table, I'd be like, oh no.
We'll adopt.
It's not happening. So, but after a couple of uses, these doctors discovered that this was really great for bone amputations as well. Mm. We no longer need to saw through your knee joint, painstaking where it takes hours and, you know, you have to chew on the belt. I'm sure you still had to chew on the belt, actually, because I don't think that the chain took the pain away. But it
Doc,
just...
Doc, I can't even feel what you're doing down
it
there.
It made it slightly easier. And then over time, this chain on a blade with a hand crank became one of the main surgeon's tool of choices. Now, it was not actually used for like trees and shrubs for another 50 years was when they finally said.
I would think it would need a motor at that point to like hand cranking would be a little bit harder to go through a tree. I would
think. Than like bone, like because it's also the size of the device. And if you think about the size, because you've got to have enough force to push the chain around the entire blade. And so if you're thinking like, you know, it's one thing if it's going around a 4-inch paring knife, but if you're pushing it around a 20-inch chainsaw, you've got to have a lot more force there. So I do feel like it would be a lot more difficult. Like it would need to be motorized by that point, but I'm not 100% sure on that fact. I'm not as up on my arborists as I am on my chainsaws for surgical purposes. So they started using it on shrubs and stuff about 50 years later. And then by the 1900s, they chopped down the first redwood with a chainsaw, which was like a big achievement. And then later it became, you know, the weapon of choice for slashers. But the beginning, the humble beginnings of the chainsaw was for childbirth.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great story.
So now that everyone is a little pale in the face and a little lightheaded... Yeah. Thank you guys for tuning in to this bonus episode of Shockwaves. We hope you have...
We'll leave you with that.
Yeah, we hope you've enjoyed our four stories of the weird, where horror movies come from and kind of the real haunting histories that surround us every day. If you enjoyed this, please like Shockwaves on Facebook if you haven't already. Like us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. Please rate and review us on iTunes. And if you enjoyed Dave and me talking about weird history and strange facts, you can check out our strange world as well. Next week, we will be back with a normal Shockwaves episode. We will, Elric and Rob will be back. I don't think Ryan will be joining us yet. He's doing a lot of traveling for July, but yeah.
And thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dave.
I had fun.
Thank you guys very much for listening, and we will be back next week.